This is Jim Inkster coming today on Talk Louisiana. We'll hear from Jeff Holman, a former public relations specialist for Entergy. Jeff Holman recalls Hurricane Gustav on the eve of the 10th anniversary of the worst hurricane to hit Baton Rouge. The storm packed wind gusts exceeding 90 miles per hour in the capital region. Lots of damage and lots of lost power. And we'll remember the tragedy and the comeback with Jeff Holman. Also, documentary filmmaker Glenn Dunsweiler. He examines the challenges of large homeless populations in many American cities. Dunsweiler says rage against homeless people is the last acceptable prejudice in our country. And author Cindy Suarez discusses her book, The Power Manual, How to Master Complex Power Dynamics. Suarez examines how power is deployed and transformed in society. Now the news on WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana on WRKF. Pleased to share the microphone with you. And if you'd like to call, 877-217-5757 is our universal number. If you're in Baton Rouge, 297-5633. And if you're inclined to send an email, talk@talklouisiana.org. We start with Jeff Holman. He was regional manager for Entergy for 4 years, and he was the public relations ace who was on the scene 10 years ago tomorrow, September 1, 2008. That date doesn't have the same relevance as August 29, 2005, but for those of us in Baton Rouge, Hurricane Gustav was worse in this area than Hurricane Katrina. It was a storm of immense magnitude, and of course we had the debris and the damage to prove it. Betsy in 1965 had sustained winds of 58 miles per hour and a maximum wind gust of 92. Hurricane Gustav in 2008 had sustained winds in Baton Rouge of 61 miles per hour and peak wind gusts of well above 90 miles per hour. So it was a storm of historic proportions. And Jeff Holman, you got a lot of phone calls on September 1st, 2008. It was a time that, of course, you have a little time to prepare, but not a whole lot, and it changed the landscape of Baton Rouge, and I'm sure many folks remember being out of power for days, if not weeks.
Yeah, absolutely, Jim, and thanks for having me. That storm, it's interesting because it's kind of frustrating to me when people talk about hurricanes. They always talk about Katrina and talk about the other storms, but people don't really bring up Gustav. Like you said, if you weren't here and you didn't live through that and the aftermath, you really don't appreciate that it was the worst storm in the history of Baton Rouge as far as Entergy's perspective, in terms of outages and damage.
How many people lost power?
When it passed through, over 90% of the city was without power.
Yeah. I remember working here on Corsi Boulevard and driving home, and I still am living in the Garden District, not knowing what I was going to find because that area was hit really hard. Fortunately for me, my house wasn't leveled, but there were some that were.
Sure. Oh, yeah. There was a lot of damage, and there were a lot of people who lost their homes. The big story was being without power, though, and you're not used to that. I mean, we're used to losing power for a couple days, but I really, at the time when I would say, before it happened, I really never envisioned a scenario where you would have customers in Baton Rouge that were without power for more than a couple days.
LSU was hit real hard. The university paid $2.2 million to clean the campus. The roof was coming off the music building, one of the beautiful facilities at the Old War School. And it was a case in which there weren't a lot of fatalities. But that night, I was the only car on the interstate driving home, and all the lights were out. It was an eerie feeling. And then when I started getting into neighborhoods, I got stopped a few times. Like, what the hell are you doing out on the roads?
Right. I'm surprised you could even get through.
Yeah, but I got home and I did not have power. But it could have been much worse as far as fatalities. And yet the city, like it did in 2016 with the worst flood in history, it recovered. But I am amazed that Gustav does not get the kind of attention in this area that Katrina got in New Orleans, because it was a substantial storm. 153 deaths across the U.S. and the Caribbean, by the way, and damage at $6 billion. It was a killer storm here and elsewhere.
And I don't know what the criteria is, but I know it is. It's one of those storms where they've retired the name. There will be no more
Gustavs. And LSU, the Tigers open Sunday in Dallas against, or Arlington, against the Miami Hurricanes of Mark Richt. But LSU played on that Saturday before the Monday storm, which was Labor Day, by the way.
Right.
And they played a 10 o'clock game. You remember that?
I do.
10 in the morning, because they were trying to beat the storm.
I sure do.
And many times before big hurricanes, the day before is a nice day because, obviously, it's a more temperate climate.
Right.
But talk about calm before the storm, huh?
Yeah. Yeah, I was. I remember that weekend, there was a Friday, like a high school football game, and they wanted to interview me on the sideline. It was like a Cox game of the week or something like that, and they wanted to interview me on the sideline of that that night. And I remember that was a Friday night before the storm hit on Monday. And I remember, you know, being really confident and thinking, well, you know, yeah, sure, you know, it'll come through and we'll have a few outages. But never in my wildest dreams that I imagined that we could have that much damage. And we actually had customers that were out for 3 weeks.
3 weeks.
Yeah, which is really
unbelievable. Yeah, I think I was out like 12 days.
That's a long time.
People
to be
get
with.
Really upset, too.
They do. And like you said, you know, I mean, it wasn't really – for us, it wasn't – I mean, there were obviously was – some loss of life, which is a tragedy. For most people, it was more of an inconvenience. But still, when you're out of power for a couple days, you know, that's okay. But when you're starting, when you're without out of power for a week or more than that, it's a serious thing.
877-217-5757. We'll spend a bit more time with Jeff Holman, who was the PR person for Entergy in Gustav time. It all erupted on Labor Day, September 1, 2008, here in Baton Rouge. And Jeff became the regional manager of Entergy and retired just a few months ago. 877-217-5757 or talk@talklouisiana.org. Here's a question from M-A-L-A, Mala, I guess it's a lady, saying, did the big wigs try to call in their chips? Jeff Holman saying, I need my power now. What's going on?
You know what? I won't name any names, but yes.
Yes?
Yes, yeah.
Really?
There was some of that. There's some of that that goes on, absolutely.
How do you handle that kind of thing?
Well, in most cases, you don't respond to that. There is a methodology that the power company uses, you know, to restore power. You're gonna use you get the biggest bang for the buck. If you can spend, you know, 4 hours getting the power on to a neighborhood of 1,000 people, you're going to do that before you do, you know, a neighborhood at the same time, a neighborhood of, or a couple, you know, just a couple of people. If you're at the end of the road, you're going to be a long time, you know, without power. If you're just on a little service by yourself. So anyway, some of those, you know, I would have to say that we had to do a couple of those, but for the most part, you try to stay away from those. And you would hope that most people don't call in those kind of favors, but you certainly get them.
Yeah. People get frustrated.
They
do. Sometimes they throw their weight around.
They do.
All right. As I've stated a few times, the killer hurricanes in Louisiana, in South Louisiana, in the region we're in, have, in my lifetime, all been the last week of August, first week of September. Mm-hmm. So we're almost out of the danger zone, the big, big danger zone. Rita was a late September, but that was, of course, more of a Lake Charles event.
Right.
And that was a bad storm, too. That one got overshadowed by Katrina. If it had just been Rita, that would have been a huge story anyway, but it would have been much bigger.
Right. And then after Gustav, you had Ike, the same kind of thing. Ike was right on the heels of Gustav, which was really difficult, too, because, you know, when you set up for a storm, you try to put your resources out of harm's way, right? And when the storm comes in, after the storm passes, then you bring all these people in to as I recall, after Gustav, we had crews from 26 states and Canada in here, all over, just because we needed so many
They came
resources.
To Baton Rouge.
They did. And there was a tremendous amount of folks that we brought in. So, yeah, you know, it's the restoration after those storms is really an animal to take on.
Well, the highest sustained winds were 155 miles per hour, so it was a big storm. And by the time it got here, of course, it was still packing a lot of might, over 90 miles per hour in wind gusts.
I know.
And that, you know, most hurricanes in New Orleans don't get that kind of force.
I know.
Some do, of course.
I know.
But to be this far inland and have that kind of power is immense and amazing.
It was. And, you know, the difference in that storm, too, was... you know, in a lot of cases, if you are in a neighborhood, I know you live in the Garden District, Jim, which is a lot of overhead lines, and you have those kind of neighborhoods that are in Baton Rouge, you can expect to be without power. But typically, if you're in a neighborhood with underground lines, your power's not off that long. And that's what frustrated people, because they can't see anything. Why is my power off? But the problem with Gustav, those winds that you just talked about, they took down gigantic structures. Big, huge transmission mm-hmm. lines that you don't know that are out in the middle of cane fields, you know, that bring power from the power stations in. And those, if those lines are out, it doesn't matter if the lines in your neighborhood are unaffected. I mean, you don't have any mm-hmm. power. And that was what the frustrating part was.
And many people may not appreciate that the people who are making the news, like you and your staff, they have homes and families, and in many cases, kind of like journalists, they don't know what the heck's going on at home.
Exactly. Well, my and at the time, you know, I had three relatively young kids, and my wife, Marcy, hung around for a couple of days, and I was never there. So after a couple of days, they packed up and headed off to Texas to stay with my brother, so because I wasn't home anyway.
All right. We'll spend a few more minutes with Jeff Holman. 877-217-5757, your number. We're back after this pause on WRKF. This is Jim Engster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. We'll be discussing one of the significant issues in American life, the homeless issue, in a few minutes. But we are continuing our discussion for a little bit with Jeff Holman, former regional manager for Entergy. And we're recalling what happened September 1, 2008. We're on the eve of the 10-year anniversary of Hurricane Gustav. And it was a storm that hit Baton Rouge. It actually, we got the brunt of it. And Jay Grimes, the former state climatologist and WAFB meteorologist, says the economic and human and social impact was worse during Gustav because more people were here to be impacted. Rose at Perkins Row.
Hi.
Good morning, Rose. You're on with Jeff.
Hey, good morning. I just wanted to say that it was something like I've never experienced. I've been through Betsy, Camille, Katrina, Ike, everything, and that was a storm like I'd never been through.
Well,
and the only way I could describe it to friends is Baton Rouge is about 2 F-stops brighter because of all the trees that we lost.
Well, you were in what part of the city, Rose?
We lived in Denham Springs at the time, and I'd left to go to my parents' house with my daughter, and it took us about 2.5 days to get back to our house because there were so many trees down.
And how long were you without power?
I think 8 days.
8 days.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a long time. Especially
it is, but these guys do a great job. I got to give props to Entergy and the whole group. We have a lot of trees and a lot of swamp area, and it's not easy to work in this climate. You know, people don't understand that don't live here. So they did a great job.
Well, thank you for sharing your story, Rose. Sure appreciate it.
Thank you.
And when we think back on those times, we think about them a lot more fondly than we do during the moment.
Right.
John McCain, we lost him, of course, 6 days ago, the senator from Arizona, but that was his big moment. He got the Republican nomination in St. Paul, Minnesota that week. The convention opened September 1st, closed September 4th, and many Louisianians didn't even get to see it on television or hear it on the radio because of the power issues that were ongoing. And I think it affected the participation by our delegation as well.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, there wasn't we were doing the after the storm. They decided to the mayor and Walter Montour at the time up at the command center up there decided that the city would do a news press conference every single day, you know, until we got the power back on. And it was televised, and that was my question. Who's watching? It's not on TV anywhere. Nobody has power. But it was on the radio. People were able to listen on the radio.
Well, you are a Baton Rouge guy, went to Redemptorist High, graduated with Howard High C. Carter and Blaine Moon Griffin,
sure
who became
did.
Griffon. And you've lived through some of this. Was there ever a storm like Gustav in Baton Rouge?
Never. No, and then I think, you know, before Entergy, of course, it was Gulf States Utilities. And Gulf States Utilities started serving in the Baton Rouge area, I think, 1924 or 1926. And there's never been a storm of that magnitude in the Baton Rouge area, never, in terms of wind, in terms of damage, in terms of outages in the city of Baton Rouge.
Well, let's hope it doesn't happen again soon. And, Jeff, it's always good to see you. Congratulations on your retirement. You look fit and ready to do whatever you're doing these days.
Thank you, Jim. It's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
We'll talk soon. Jeff Holman, good man. We're visiting now with Glenn Dunsweiler. He is a documentary filmmaker, and he's out to change perceptions of people living on the street. He spent substantial time with them and the professionals who work with them. And, Glenn, you believe that ridicule and perhaps contempt for the homeless is the last acceptable prejudice in the United States. So why do you think so?
Thanks for having me. So the way we talk about homelessness in the United States, there's always this edge of contempt, and there's always this us versus them mentality. What are we going to do about the homeless? And we talk about them, as my friend would say, smog, something to eradicate. And the conversations about this is actually a population of people that don't have personal support systems in their time of need really never come up in a practical sense. Maybe it comes up in pity, but other than that, it's just they're dehumanized and seen as an issue rather than a group of people.
Well, as 2018 began, the U.S. Census Bureau indicates 553,000 Americans are homeless. One out of every five, 20% of them, live in either New York City or Los Angeles. It is New York City with 77,000 and Los Angeles with 55,000, and you are in Los Angeles. A distinct issue. If you travel to Los Angeles, you're going to see homeless people. You're probably going to see them in Baton Rouge or New Orleans, but still, Los Angeles may be the weather. A lot of people gravitate to that area.
It's a multiple kind of confluence of issues that Los Angeles is a very spacious area. And yes, it's a destination location, it's the weather, but it's also this, mainly the city just kind of gave up on this 6-square-block area. And the worst of the worst of people that are in the worst emotional states, really, and our mental states, they're kind of, it kind of has turned into an escape from New York situation where just let them be there. And the city has felt overwhelmed, but they've had the space, unlike, let's say, a city like San Francisco, which has no space. They've had this, the city's decided that they're just going to have an area, and as long as they can keep it kind of contained and quarantined, it's bedlam down there, and you just do what you do, and the cops kind of roll through to see who they can bust. But now we've even got, there's a report, I think Vice News did, that gangs in L.A. are now charging homeless people rent for their tents on the sidewalk, and a certain gang will take a certain block, and another gang has agreed to take another block, and they're extorting homeless people.
Well, these people are living on the street. I would think in most cases they either have mental challenges or perhaps are drug addicted. But it's apparent that many of them are in need and may not know how to get help. There are shelters all over the country. In fact, there are many right here in Baton Rouge. Why aren't these people in shelters?
Yeah. So people come to homelessness for many different reasons, and there are definitely the drug addicted, the mentally ill, the people that have kind of given up on life, the depressed. But then there are a lot of people that come to it because their roommate moved out, or they got hurt, or their family got tired of them. And those people aren't necessarily in on the street. They're in abandoned buildings. They're sleeping in their car. They're kind of the hidden homeless. And shelters are an answer, but so many times I've talked to people that just find that the shelter that's offered is not the answer for them. So, for example, they've got a young mother with a child, and she decides that she can't control her child is going to meet at the shelter. So she feels much safer being with her child than introducing her to possible drug addicts or mentally ill that may have come to the shelter. Or there are people that just aren't able to work with the timeline that the shelter gives them. Okay, you need to be looking for a job and getting a job within 3 months. Otherwise, you have to go. And then if you don't have it within 3 months, we have to kick you out because we have to wait, have someone else. And then there's also religion tied to it. So some people just don't feel comfortable going to Bible study if they're not Christian.
All right, hold tight. We're visiting with Glenn Dunzweiler. He is a documentary filmmaker who says there is one prejudice that even the most politically correct people are likely to harbor, and it's distaste for the homeless. 877-217-5757. We're back after this news break with Karen Henderson. This is Jim Inkster. Pleased to have you with us for Talk Louisiana. Your number is 877-217-5757. The Baton Rouge dial is 297-5633. We're with Glenn Dunzweiler. He's a documentary filmmaker. He's also written a book called Things I've Learned from the Homeless. He lives in Los Angeles, the number two city in America as far as homeless people. New York is one, Los Angeles two, perhaps not coincidentally. Those are also the two largest cities in America. But then we get to largely temperate climates. Seattle is number three for homeless. San Diego is four. Washington, D.C., it can get pretty cold in the district, but it's number five, followed by San Jose, California, San Francisco, and Las Vegas. In Louisiana, we have an estimated 3,305 people who are homeless in our state, and that ranks ahead of Arkansas and Mississippi, but we have more people. It's comparable to the 3,700 in the great state of Alabama. But Glenn says prejudice, contempt for the homeless, it's the last politically correct prejudice, if there is any such thing, that you can poke fun, you can ridicule, you can ostracize people who are homeless. And sometimes when we encounter these panhandlers with exotic stories, or we're at a traffic light and we're trying to get somewhere and somebody's banging on the window asking for money, it can be a little daunting to not strike back. But what should we do in a case like that, Glenn?
Well, panhandlers, if they had four walls and a roof over them, we'd call them entrepreneurs. And they are just people that have decided to take it in their own hands to make their own money and getting the donations they can. So really, it's a business transaction. They're asking you to enter into a business transaction. They can give you entertainment or make you feel that you're helping your fellow man, or letting you pet their dog for whatever money you have. And it's really just, if you want to enter into that transaction, do it. If you don't. Because panhandlers aren't necessarily homeless. Panhandlers are just business people. And that's really the best way that I've found to approach it is, hey, do I want to enter into this transaction? And if I don't, it's fine. There's no judgment. There's just go spend your money somewhere else, or go help somewhere else if you like. But really, it's just a way for someone to make their own money.
Well, the presentation can make all the difference. And sometimes it's, hey, man, you got some money. You got, you know, it's not very nuanced. And then there are times when we may give something to one person, and then a block later we hit by another one and another one and another one. And then finally it's like, I can't contribute right to everybody or I'll go broke. That can be a bit frustrating, Glenn.
Absolutely, absolutely. And what I do is, if I don't have cash or I don't want to give cash and I don't feel safe giving cash, I just look people in the eye, because they're still humans and they deserve my respect to be looked in the eye. And I say, sorry, I don't have it. And then I move on. And, yeah, if we've got Panhandler Roll, where you're walking through and getting hit up for money 4 to 5 to 6 times, then that's some point for the community to say, okay, this is getting ridiculous. We need to figure out what we can do to curb this, because it's making my life outside not enjoyable. But it's a community issue, right? And I just was at I don't know if you have them in Louisiana, Trader Joe's grocery store, and they hired, I think, a panhandler chaser. But she wouldn't cop to it. She would not admit that her job was just to make sure that panhandlers were not out in front of the store, because I'm sure mm-hmm. their constituents were complaining about being hit up for money. And, yeah, you try to be the better person, but you're a human being. And how many times are you nice to people who call nonprofits who are asking for money? I mean, yes, you give to the Cancer Society, and yes, you give to the police force, and yes, you give to the who else and who else. But after 5 or 6 telephone calls, you're going to feel the same way. So,
all right,
it's kind of that same approach, just really reminding yourself that they're just people asking for donations, and it just may be that you get 6 of them in a row, and that is very unfortunate.
All right. A listener recommends the Living Waters Drop-In Center. I see that's at 3255 Hollywood Street, one of the 11 shelters I see listed in Baton Rouge. And the number, by the way, for that one is 225-248-1054. There's, of course, St. Vincent de Paul, Youth Oasis, and many others. So we do try to care for the homeless in Baton Rouge, and we have an issue here, as do most relatively large American cities, but not nearly the kind of issue that places like Los Angeles and San Diego and Las Vegas, places you know well. And if I were a homeless person, I would definitely choose California, because I could live on the streets year-round. In Louisiana, it's hard in the summertime. In New York, it's hard in the summer and the wintertime, but yet New York City has more homeless than anyone else.
Yeah, that's really interesting, because Manhattan is a 24-hour city. So I talked to panhandlers in Manhattan, and they said they feel safe on the street and actually not safe in the shelters, because shelters can often be a magnet for crime, so for drug dealers and pimps to hang out. So they felt safer on the street. But if your town isn't a 24-hour town, there's no way you feel safe on the street once the lights go out at night. And it's a very different dynamic in every city. And I, you know, there are homeless in Philadelphia that they'll be out and freezing. People say, why don't you go to San Diego? And since Philadelphia is my home, this is, I have nothing else, and I'm not going to give up my home.
There you go.
And
Phil in Jefferson Terrace. Phil, you're on with Glenn Dunsweiler, documentary filmmaker and the author of Things I've Learned from the Homeless. Hi, Phil.
Hi, Jim. Good morning, sir. Yeah, I understand that at one point in time in New Orleans, while Mayor Landrieu was the mayor, there were 5,000 homeless in the city, and obviously try to shift them around so that they don't interrupt or hurt the tourist trade. Is there a way to find out how many, like currently in New Orleans, or, you know, where you live, how many homeless are actually there? And another thing I would point out is that, you know, these people aren't crazy because they're poor. I mean, they're crazy. I'm sorry, they're not poor because they're crazy. They're crazy because they're poor. I mean, the slide down into homelessness is a trip in misery. So anyway, thank you.
All right. Many mayors tout their ability to get the homeless out of Dodge. I know Rudy Giuliani did that when he was mayor of New York City and got a lot of plaudits for them. Where did those people go?
To other communities. There have been multiple articles written about how, let's say, San Diego ships their homeless to Los Angeles and San Francisco ships their homeless to Oregon or something like that. And that's just been a very common way, just born out of frustration. What are we going to do? Our constituents are angry with us. We mm-hmm. need to get this homeless thing solved. I know, we'll just give them one-way bus tickets and make it someone else's problem. And it happens, you know, I don't fault cities. They're reacting, and they're reacting out of frustration, and they don't know what to do, and there are no short-term quick fixes except get them out of here and deal with it later and deal with the fallout later. And I think that's what happened.
You say there's about a six-block section in Los Angeles. That's relatively close to downtown, isn't it?
Yeah. Right next to Little Tokyo.
Yeah, not far from police headquarters, and there you are, and it's quite a sight. Jennifer Grant, the daughter of Cary Grant, I read in the New York Times, actually goes to that area and bring some of her dad's suits. Can you imagine what they would be worth, these expensive suits, and gives them to the homeless?
Interesting. I mean, if those homeless are going to job interviews, they could absolutely use those suits. But then again, you think about where they're going to store those suits, how those suits are going to remain clean. Where's this person going to shower before they put that suit on? You know, a simple gift becomes maybe a burden when you don't have a consistent place to stay.
Glenn, there are good homeless people and bad homeless people, just like every other sector of society. These people who congregate at traffic lights. In Little Rock last year, I actually saw two well-built guys fighting over a spot right at a major intersection. They looked like they could bench press their weight, and yet they're out there asking for money from people who are pulling up to a traffic light. It was an amusing sight.
Yeah, and there's just because you're asking for money doesn't, let me rephrase that. You can still need the money even though you don't look homeless. I talked to a few panhandlers that say, I have to look like crap or no one gives me money. And that's kind of interesting because it's a lot cheaper to look nice than it is to get housing.
Well, many of them have these signs, and some of them say, like, Vietnam veteran. And I look at the guy, and he's probably 35, and I think, I don't think so.
Right, absolutely. He's not a Vietnam veteran, and it's a bit of entertainment. And my favorite sign was looking for money for cold beer and fat butt ladies. Okay.
Well, Glenn asks, why is it okay to give $10 to the Salvation Army but not to a panhandler? And you have a point. Glenn Dunsweiler, the author of Things I've Learned from the Homeless. I hope we talk again in happier times, but I'm sure this is an issue that will permeate for some time. Thank you, Glenn.
Thank you.
We're back after this pause with author Cindy Suarez. This is Jim Inkster, and thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana, and we are pleased to be joined by Cindy Suarez. She works with leaders in nonprofit organizations, philanthropy, social movements, and politics, and her book is The Power of Manual: How to Master Complex Power Dynamics. And it is a big subject, and you give it your best shot and try to make this something that we can appreciate in layman's terms, but it is something that I'm sure took a lot of work from you, Cindy Suarez.
Yes, it sure did. I've been thinking about this book since I was a teenager. So I've done a lot of studying, lots of academic studying, working in the field, and really when I got to the point where I really needed a new way of thinking about this, I finally sat down to write it.
Well, power is a part of all of our lives, and many of us, whether we want to acknowledge it or not, we strive to have some power over our destiny. How does that compute with the research you've done?
Well, that's actually a really interesting point, because actually power has different ways that people think about it, and one of the first things I do is differentiate between the two sort of core types of power. Supremacist power, which is the ability to dominate others, and then liberatory power, which is the ability to create what you want. So, you know, the fact that you asked that question is actually speaks to the second definition, which is great. We all want to be able to affect our destiny and create the life we want, and that impinges on others. So those, as we all go about our lives trying to create the lives we want, we have to be really careful how that intersects with other people's doing the same thing. So it actually falls right square in the middle of the first chapter, your question.
You ask what is power and how does one obtain power in a society that, of course, many of us are viewed as being powerless. So how do we do it?
Well, there are different ways that people obtain power. One of the ways is to try to get it from other people, but we actually learn how to obtain power when we are young. And that's one of the things that I found is that the power process is developmental. So we all have very different ways of learning power, and that's what a two-year-old know is all about. It's learning to impose their will on the world and seeing what happens. And so if you happen to grow up in an environment where people engage you in your desires and negotiate with you, you learn that you have power, that you actually have the power to make claims on others and to have that be engaged. Some people don't have that engaged. They may get punished for that. So there are different ways in which we learn power, and by the time we're adults, you know, we keep developing power. There are different developmental levels, even as adults, that we can move beyond. But some of us never get to the point of even feeling that we have power. So, and I think people think of that, one of the confusing things is that people oftentimes overlay that with the isms, you know, racism, classism, sexism. And so those are definitely ways that society stratifies power. But then in all of those different identities are people that have personal experiences. So it's actually a very complex topic that has both personal developmental phases and then social conditions. So that's what my book is about. I try to make it simple, but there are a lot of frameworks that bring all of these ideas together to help people understand how to move through that and really how to make choices, how to become aware of those moments in our lives when we have the choice to enact power or disrupt power dynamics, and how do we actually learn to see those moments and then learn to choose. Most choice is unconscious for people. We have to learn to make those, to make choice conscious.
We're visiting with Cindy Suarez. Her book is The Power Manual. You write that we all want power, the power to attract the love we want, the power to create what we want to see in the world, the power to avoid harm. But these are, of course, wildly different propositions, and you note that there is a power of being supreme and there is a power of being liberated. Are the methods to achieve that power, are they similar or are they different?
I think there are different ways, and in the book there are, I mean, I look at 10 different fields of study. So there are different ways to look at power depending on the situation, but underlying them all are some really core ideas that actually were shared across all 10 fields of study. You know, one of them is that the real point of power is in interactions. So there are societal structures of power, but those tend to be artifacts of how we've chosen to interact. So that's one thing that cuts across. The other thing is that power is triggered by difference. How do people perceive difference? When do we perceive someone as different? So all of these things are really important to understanding power. Like, some people are attracted to difference. They're curious. Some people are threatened by that. So we're all positioned differently. And also, power skills are learnable. People can learn to note power, to understand the signs of it, and to learn how to interrupt it towards more sort of mutual ways of being. But it really, what I learned is that it takes a lot of discipline to be free. It really does. It's almost, and that's where you get into the supreme power, which comes from the Vedic scriptures. And so I did find that actually there is really a core underlying truth underneath all these different fields of study, and that is that it takes discipline to be free. It's not for the weak of heart. It takes consciousness. It takes intention. It takes choice. And then, you know, acting and reflecting on that. So it's a sort of a fine-tuning of one's consciousness. And I think also what happens is that what I learned is that our bodies use glucose. That's the sort of energy that we create. You know, we work, we go to school, we eat, so that our bodies can have energy to expend in the world. And we expend that in the form of our attention, what we pay attention to. So what happens is when you really start to become clear about what you're creating in the world and you focus your attention, you actually start to create it. That's what I have found. So there's a lot of power in that, to really understanding the discipline of attention and focus and intention, and then pursuing that almost like a yogi. As far as I'm seeing, you actually do create the world you want. You can have quite an influence on it.
You have a chapter on body language, and I recall Hillary Clinton saying that when she met with Vladimir Putin, that he conducted the meeting with his legs spread apart. She called it man-spreading, and you say that this is indicative of power. How so?
That comes from the theater world. So one of the things I learned, my daughter is a sort of actor, and she's actually studying in school now, but throughout our life, I, you know, took her to different theater events and trainings, and as she got deeper into it, I started to learn that there was this field of theater, mostly from improv, where people really have to learn how to shift status quickly, and they have actors actually learn how to use their bodies in powerful ways, how to speak in powerful ways, how to take up space in powerful ways, or in powerless ways. So yeah, that is one of the ways that actors are taught. But that comes from studying humans and just seeing how do you portray a character on stage. So that doesn't come from me. That comes from the theater world and from research on humans and how humans actually use their body to exert power. There are many ways. Mm-hmm. But, yeah, that is one of them.
Well, we as humans, we quite often have power over people in our lives, and they have power over us. And of course, we're all subject to the power that the government that has that we live in. How do we deal with that? Do most people handle it well?
Oh, I think we have a long ways to go. I mean, one of the things I found is that, you know, even social change agents, people who are out there with the full intention of shifting the world towards a, you know, what people may think is a better place, use the same dominant power dynamics. So, and I come from that field. I spent the last 2.5 decades working in movements, as you say, when you introduced me. And yeah, that's why I wrote this book. I saw a lot of the same dynamics in that work in civil society. So there is a long way to go. With a shift of consciousness, a lot can change. What I believe and what I've learned through research is that when there is alignment and when there is a focus of energy, especially if you have it at a collective level, then that is unstoppable in terms of creating the world that we want. And I think now more than ever, when so many people feel powerless, understanding how much power we actually do have with our consciousness and our intention and how we choose every minute of the day to interact. Actually, we do have a lot of power to counteract that. It's easy to see this sort of context around us as all powerful, but it's really not.
Well, it's a fascinating book, and it is certainly one about mastering power dynamics from Cindy Suarez. The book is The Power Manual, and it's been a pleasure. Thanks for joining us, Cindy.
Thank you, Jim.
And just an example of observation from Cindy, she says, smooth body movements indicate high status. Jerky body movements denote low status. Putting one's hands near one's face while speaking is low status, writes Cindy, and hands away from face while talking is high status, and moving slowly is high status. Moving fast is low status. Interesting observations from Cindy Suarez in the Power Manual. LSU's football team will try to assert its power over Miami of Florida come Sunday in Arlington, Texas at AT&T Stadium, 6:30 kickoff. We'll be talking about that Monday. LSU's a 3.5-point underdog to number 8 Miami. Also Monday, Jason Berry, the reporter who really broke the story first about sexual abuse in the Catholic Church, and he'll have some observations about what's going on now. It's been a tough time for the Catholic Church in recent days, with revelations near and far, both in the United States and abroad. And yesterday, as we noted, was the 100th anniversary of the birth of Ted Williams, Teddy Ballgame, perhaps the greatest hitter, pure hitter ever. And he was a guy who was acerbic, to say the least, and you didn't want to ask him a question he didn't like. And Tracy at the Capitol asked if we could find this tape, and Matt Doyle has, of Stuttering John of the Howard Stern Show asking Ted Williams a question he didn't particularly like.
By any chance, did you ever accidentally fart in the catcher's face?
Pardon?
By any chance, did you ever accidentally fart in the catcher's face?
Who the hell are you? For John's sake, that kind of damn question. See you later.
That was Ted Williams. Denny McLean was rather charitable to him yesterday. Those two didn't like each other very much, but Denny, I guess, trying not to speak ill of the dead, gave his best shot at praising Ted Williams, great hitter, 482 on base percentage. Imagine that. Best ever. See you later. Stay tuned.